Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I've come to know and greatly admire a man who has been fighting an important battle in that war for the free world in what he calls the buckle of the Bible Belt in Nashville, Tennessee. He is Bill Warner, a prolific contributor to our understanding of the challenges we're facing these days from what I think is best described as Sharia supremacism. Bill, unlike most of us, comes to this with a very extraordinary personal career and record in the hard sciences, including serving, among other things, as a professor at Tennessee State University in the engineering school. He has a PhD in physics and math, no less, but has devoted much of his life to the work of the Center for Political Islam. And he has been contributing, as I say, extraordinarily through videos, through monographs, through longer book-length treatments of the Quran and Muhammad's life and the political traditions of Muhammadan example. It is great to have him back. Thank you so much, Bill, for taking a few minutes with us.
Glad to be with you, Frank.
A report that recently was produced in the United Kingdom caught my eye, and I wanted to talk to you about it, Bill. It was produced by the Center on Religion and Geopolitics, and it's entitled For Caliph and Country, explaining how British jihadis join a global movement. I'm keen to hear your thoughts on its critical finding, it seems, which is that so-called non-violent Islamists often wind up espousing and perhaps even acting upon jihadist directives. Talk a bit about that, if you would, Bill.
Well, this is all under the head. Sorry there. This all fits under the heading of duh, because the meaning is hidden in the word Islamist, which has a peculiar word. I call it Islam. But they say, you know, an Islamist is someone who practices all of Islam and who thinks that Islam should rule both politics and religion. And that, of course, is nothing more than the doctrine laid out in the Quran, the Sirah, and the Hadith. That is, it's normal. So what they seem to express surprise at, that somebody who would accept that Islam is a civilizational force would be surprised to find out that it goes on and practices all of the doctrine, which includes the doctrine of jihad.
Well, I think that's all important groundwork, but the piece that I'm particularly keen on is we're often told, as you know, that the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, is not a problem, but it is part of the solution because it is nonviolent. This study, and certainly my understanding of it, and much of that is informed by your work, is that, you actually are dealing with people who embrace, when they embrace Sharia, a jihadist agenda that runs the gamut from nonviolence all the way through the most violent of forms.
Well, we have to understand what the word jihad means. It does not mean holy war. It does not mean mass assassinations, although it can include those things. So what we have here is a doctrine which states that Islam is to rule all aspects of life. And by the way, I think that the Muslim Brotherhood is far more dangerous to our civilization than Al-Qaeda or Islamic State.
Amen. But to the extent that we have, and we'll talk more about this shortly with our colleague Phil Haney, allowed the Muslim Brotherhood in this country, under both Republican and Democratic administrations, by the way, to help define our understanding of jihad, or for that matter, Sharia. Bill Warner, what are the implications of that as you see it in terms of both getting this right and protecting ourselves adequately against it?
well, Islam has no respect for either Democrat or Republican. Those who are Democrat or Republican and think they can make friends with the Muslim Brotherhood are smoking the wrong smoking material, I'll tell you that right now.
Well, and to the extent that we are smoking that, I'm mindful that today the President of the United States is endorsing a plan, at least as we speak. This is expected to be imminently done. We'll be airing this program after it is, but assuming the reporting is correct, the President of the United States is buying into this idea that he can declare that an agreement, a political understanding, I guess more accurately described, with Iran, a very Sharia supremacist operation, is neither being complied with by the Iranians nor in the national security interests of the United States. And yet, we're going to stay inside that deal and try to negotiate better terms. Based on your understanding of what animates folks like the mullahs in Iran, Bill Warner, how's that likely to work out?
Well, what I hate is that we're going into a negotiation and we keep on saying we have no interest who we're negotiating with. We have no interest what their doctrine of war is. As a matter of fact, we would seem to be embarrassed to think that Islam even has a doctrine of war. We've fallen into the trap of being friendly Americans who think if we're nice to somebody, they're going to be nice to us. Now, there are cases in our social lives when that is true. But to base your whole politics on that we can compromise our way to victory is beyond me. And it's also beyond me how we can still keep on dealing with Islam and keep pretending like there's nothing to learn about it in terms of its war doctrine. It drives me crazy, Frank.
Well, I understand, and me too, to be honest, Bill. But the key point here is that doing that when you don't know who you're dealing with is one thing. Presuming that somebody will deal with you in good faith and will, you know, exercise sort of restraint in their dealings with you, when you're dealing with people who made no secret, indeed had made public policy of their commitment to bring death to America since 1979, for heaven's sake. It's unbelievable.
I mean, how clear can you make it? I mean, how many times we don't see them lately, those black masses in the Tehran Square, but I can still remember them, death to America. And no one's ever rescinded that. And as a matter of fact, death to America really is just another Sharia statement. That's all that it is, just bold and frank.
Yeah, it's as direct, though, as they can make it, and we ignore it at our extreme peril. Hey, Bill, let me ask you about a couple of things that you've been writing about lately. You've published a piece with the provocative title that you admire Islam. You've also been writing about our relative inability to defend our sort of Judeo-Christian rooted civilization against it. And you've actually put together a detailed dynamic battle map that has some 8 million hits over its life. Talk about all of that, if you would, quickly, and why it's important for us to take this kind of insight aboard.
Well, I would say that most people do not have any idea about the military relationship between Islam and the West. And so I did a bit of research and put together some 548 battles that had been fought by Islam against classical civilization. And then I came up with the idea of what I call a dynamic battle map. I compressed 1,200 years of jihad into 2 minutes. And it's called Why We Are Afraid. And I took the title because that's one of the questions I used to be asked a lot, aren't I afraid? So Why We Are Afraid, 8 million views. It's enlightenment in 2 minutes, military enlightenment in 2 minutes.
And Bill, just in closing, what I think you've done in this regard, as in so many others, is really make very accessible to the rest of us, information that is often poorly portrayed or certainly understood. And it's an incredibly valuable service. And I just want to, again, commend to all of our listeners and to everyone else we can reach the importance of Dr. Bill Warner's work in laying out the nature of this Sharia supremacist enemy we're facing, their determination to destroy us, and the dangers associated with thinking otherwise. Bill Warner, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I do hope you'll come back. We haven't spoken with you for a full hour in far too long. I'd like to do that again in the very near future. In the meantime, thank you so much. Come back to us keep up the good work in the meantime. We'll talk with Phil Haney, as promised, up next, a plank holder, founding member of the Department of Homeland Security, who became a whistleblower of what was going on under the previous administration, and we'll have some shocking information about what's going on now. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to have with us Philip Haney, a remarkable public servant, now retired from the Department of Homeland Security, which he helped found, serving for 13 years, as I recall, as an armed customs and border protection officer, including several tours of duty in the National Targeting Center in Washington, D.C., where he brought to bear an extraordinary intellect and depth of knowledge about the jihadist threat, the doctrine of Sharia that animates it, and the tactics of the global jihad movement that Sharia inspires. He is the co-author with Art Moore of a best-selling book, See Something, Say Nothing: A Homeland Security Officer Exposes the Government's Submission to Jihad. Phil Haney, welcome back. It is so good to have you, sir.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
You know, we were talking in the previous segment with another great freedom fighter, Bill Warner, out of Tennessee. I asked him about a study, and I wanted to get your thoughts on it as well. In fact, there are two by this organization in Britain, the Center on Religion and Geopolitics, both of which have warned about the so-called nonviolent Islamists in our midst and their agenda, which it turns out is identical to that of those who would use violence as a first recourse. Phil, based on your experience, is this a surprising finding or absolutely obvious?
No, it's not surprising at all. I think of it as a gravitational force like we see in the space movies. The closer you get to the sun, the faster you go as it draws you into its gravitational field. You walk into the world of Islam, and if you're dedicated and focused on it, you are going to eventually come to the center of the ideology, which is implementation of Sharia law by the use of violence, if necessary, also known as jihad.
How is that manifested in the conduct of, say, groups like the Muslim Brotherhood?
One of the things that you will find when you read these studies for Caliph and Country and Milestones to Militancy that were put out by the Tony Blair Institute, to find these conclusions and confirm that the Muslim Brotherhood is the gravitational force of the global Islamic movement is really shattering to the CVE, Countering Violent Extremism, narrative. The Muslim Brotherhood ideology saturates the entire global Islamic movement. And if you enter into this arena and you stay focused on the ideology that you're being taught and that you embrace, it inevitably leads you to confrontation with governments and individuals who are not Sharia compliant, which, after all, is the entire purpose of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's a revivalist movement started in 1928 specifically to bring back the caliphate and implement Sharia law on a global level, and that's exactly what they're still doing today.
But Phil, you have seen this firsthand, the presence of Muslim Brotherhood operatives in advisory roles at the Department of Homeland Security under Barack Obama, in some cases actually as employees in that agency or others in the government. How is it that, knowing what you know about the Brotherhood and the role it plays in promoting Sharia supremacism and its mission of destroying us in the United States, as well as imposing this caliphate under Sharia worldwide, that we're allowing these kinds of individuals inside the wire, let alone having the sort of influence that you just alluded to there with respect to defining and implementing this so-called countering violent extremism program.
Well, put some numbers on it. Somewhere between 25 and 35 individuals I documented during the course of my career that were given positions of influence and authority within the executive branch or the legislative branch or the judicial branch of the government. And how they do it, they're very persuasive. They attach themselves to concepts like civil rights and civil liberties, equality, fairness, etc., and kind of attract the political structure and persuade them that they're the nice Muslims and that those guys over there in Syria and Iraq, those are the bad Muslims, but not us. We renounce violence. And that's what the key to this whole conversation is. They renounce violence, they say, but it turns out that these two recent studies contradict that severely. They may renounce violence verbally, but they're in the middle of the global jihad movement. And that is a remarkable accomplishment to be able to persuade individuals at the highest level of power that they're peaceful while simultaneously carrying on a global jihad movement, which is exactly the reason why we need to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. Everybody in Congress needs to read these two reports and then come to the obvious conclusion. This group is a threat to us, and we need to get busy and designate them.
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, we all anticipated that that was going to be one of the things done early on by President Trump, who not only spoke very articulately about the need to have a fundamental course correction from what you struggled with in terms of the Obama embrace of the Muslim Brotherhood, but also the idea that he was going to roll up the networks that were, as he said, radicalizing in our communities. And those, of course, were the brotherhoods, mosques, and Islamic societies, and front groups of various other kinds. Phil Haney, based upon your long experience with all of this, your close observation as a guy who studies things like insects as a profession, as well as these kinds of bugs, you've got an insight, I'm sure, into what's going on inside the Trump administration at the moment. Are there still Muslim Brotherhood operatives or sympathizers or enablers inside our government as you see it? And if so, is that why the Trump administration has not designated the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization?
I think it is. Even aside from the exact number of individuals who may be affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood are still inside, what is more fundamental is the ideology, the worldview that they have transferred over to us, entire structures of the government, that if we simply find a way to coexist with Islam and not address the ideology that drives it, that gravitational force, that somehow we'll be immune to the forces or the effects of this global movement, but we won't be. And that's another thing these studies pointed out. The journey into violent jihad doesn't come from the internet. It comes from the mosque, it comes from the structures like the Muslim Brotherhood, and it comes from who you know. The whole concept of this arbitrary radicalization, like a meteor from space that hits you, is false. It's always a network, and it's always the individuals. And that is what I focused on when I was active duty, and that's also what got me in so much trouble.
This is a subject for another day. We've got so much more on that score to talk about. Phil, I hope you'll come back to us soon for that purpose, but in the meantime, I appreciate tremendously the work you do, among other things, as a senior fellow for the Center for Security Policy. Your book on See Something, Say Nothing is required reading for all of us as we wrestle with this particular part of this war for the free world. Phil, thanks so much for joining us today. Next up, we'll speak with Mark Labuie from Canada about the war on freedom of speech there that's coming to a theater near you. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Mark Labui, a very courageous and thoughtful contributor to the defense of the free world, is the way I think of it, in Canada. He is the founder and director of a terrific online resource, The Tipping Point, or in French, Point de Bascule, based in Montreal. He has been closely following for a long time the challenges that his country is facing, some of which are not only of import for us, but of late have actually emanated from this country. We wanted to talk to him about a recent terrorist incident in Edmonton, Canada, and what Islamists are doing in its aftermath to further restrict freedom of speech in particular in Canada. Mark Labui, it is so good to have you back, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with this incident in which a number of people were killed in Edmonton back on September 30th, Mark. We've not spoken since then. How did it come about? Who perpetrated it? And as best we can tell, why?
Well, there was an attack on September 30th of this year. And basically, the police constable, Mike Chernik, was hit and stabbed by 30-year-old Abdul Sharif, who then hit four other pedestrians with a rental truck in a police chase. Basically, what the police discovered, they confirmed the presence of an ISIS flag in the van that rammed the police officer. This is a very rare instance where a terrorist came to Canada via the United States rather than the other way around. Just for a reminder, there was the case recently in 2006 of El Banassi, who was arrested in 2016 after traveling from Canada to New Jersey to carry out a terrorist attack. He was targeting concert venues, subway stations, Times Square. And then just recently, you might remember, was also Amorf Touhi, a Tunisian, a Montrealer of Tunisian extraction, who crossed the border, went to Detroit at a small Detroit airport, a Michigan airport, and stabbed a police officer in the neck several times. And then there was the famous Millennium Bomber who was caught just luckily by the Border Patrol, who his name is Ahmed Ressam, who was also from Montreal again.
But what do we know about this chap?
Well, what's amazing is this guy, a 30-year-old Somali national. What basically happens is he crossed the Mexican border undocumented, and then ICE, the immigration, caught him. They detained him for 4 months in order to deport him, and this was in 2011. He was then released in 2011 again with what they call an order of suspension. And then in January 2012, ICE lost track of him, and he subsequently crossed the Canadian border, and then he requested refugee status, and to my understanding, he got his refugee status. So there's a huge issue with this guy about the vetting process, because he went through two checkpoints. On one side, ICE did their job, and maybe there hasn't been enough communication or whatever happened with the refugee status. But this definitely brings up a case where if maybe this individual was not caught at the Mexican border, would he have done a terror attack inside the United States? That would be a question that would be worthy. There's been, because of Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, invited right after the U.S. election, the Trump administration, Justin Trudeau basically sent out a tweet inviting all the refugees to come into Canada. I'm not using his words, but basically that's how it's understood. And many, many people responded to the call. So the Quebec border in particular has been heavily one of the most intensely busy border where many, many, many claimants to refugee status has gone through. They say that it's been almost just this year alone, over 10,000 of them. Many of them were Haitian, but a huge proportion of them were also from the Middle East or North Africa. Now, what we heard is that, according to the Canadian press, under the Obama administration, they allowed American visas to be issued via the U.S. Embassy in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia in order for these people to go through the United States and cross over to Canada. And then we know just recently in Quebec alone that in the last 6 months, I believe, there's been almost 43,000 immigrants. These are registered. We're not even talking necessarily of immigrants or undocumented. 43,000 for a population of 8 million people would mean for the United States, it's as if in 6 months, there would be in the United States 1,720,000 people that would have entered the United States in 6 months.
A significant impact in all kinds of senses, economic, political, as well as perhaps security. And Mark Labuie, you were telling me something interesting a moment ago about how the Islamists in Canada have responded to this act of jihad by this this Somali expatriate by doubling down on their effort to suppress freedom of speech that might give offense to Muslims in Canada. Can you talk a little bit about that? And again, we're interested in this because it seems as though it's a kind of canary in the mineshaft moment for us here in the United States as we face efforts in this country to suppress our freedoms, our constitutionally guaranteed freedom of expression.
Absolutely. And also the constitutionally guaranteed freedom as well in Canada. So basically these, I'm being told it's not the right term, but it's almost as if the best description would be we're using sublegal structures in a certain way. So there's all these non-official people nominated to run these like agencies, and they're using their powers to be able to erode our freedoms and the freedom of speech in particular. They're using these human rights commissions, or their most recent case was in the Toronto School Board, which basically they published a guide, which is about 170 pages long. And they have a critical definition of Islamophobia that they wanted to get approved by the board. And it has two, by the way, it has two versions, because right after they received tremendous pressure to pull out that definition, they subsequently changed it to the one that was defined by the Ontario School Board. But this one was the first definition was replaced after the Islamophobia included the fear of Islamic politics. So imagine the notion of fear of Islamic politics. If you express that, if you criticize that, it would be perceived as something that could be, you would be penalized if you would express those fears.
And we've actually seen people in Canada like Mark Stein and Ezra Levant actually subjected to this kind of prosecution. So this is not an abstract concern. And Mark Labuie, as you sit there now, to what extent would you argue that the kinds of pressure that you're under, whether it's from these refugees or asylum seekers or people simply coming in illegally across our borders, as well as what is being done to suppress the freedom of speech in Canada, is really engineering a kind of fundamental transformation of Canada, to coin a phrase?
Well, some people are literally talking about population replacement. And I mean, when we're looking at the numbers at one point or another, numbers do represent quality.
Quantity has a quality all its own, as I think Stalin once said. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, exactly. And well, I think when people are looking at Europe, we're seeing the problems that even caused Brexit, one has to maybe see Canada as if it was a European country, it might be worse than what's happening in Germany.
We have to leave it at that for the moment, Mark Labuie. I'm so sorry. We are hard out of time, but this is an entry point into a much longer conversation about what is really a lesson for all of us about what's happening north of our border. I appreciate so much your clarity as well as your courage in discussing these issues at Point de Bascule, Tipping Point. It is of such importance, and we appreciate your time as well. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Dakota Wood of the Heritage Foundation about the death spiral America's military is now facing at a most dangerous time in world affairs. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Dakota Wood, an extraordinary resource when it comes to matters involving the national security of the United States, the threats to it, and the adequacy of our preparations to contend with them. He is these days a senior research fellow in defense programs in the Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy at the Heritage Foundation, but he brings to it two decades of experience in the United States Marine Corps, serving multiple deployments in the thick of the fight, what I call the war for the free world, helping with strategic analysis and planning as well at high levels of his service, the direct support of the Commandant of the Marine Corps for a time, as well as in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. I could go on and on, but suffice it to say, he brings a lot to the party, including his role as the editor of the brand new 2018 Index of Military Strength, a publication of the Heritage Foundation that I think is simply indispensable. And I'm delighted to welcome its author here. Welcome back, Dakota. It's been too long, but we're very glad to have you with us. Congratulations on the new product.
Thank you. Very proud of it. It was a great team that brought it together. And thanks, Frank, for having this, having me on to talk about our insights on that.
Well, and I want to do this at greater length soon, Dakota. So this is just going to be an hors d'oeuvre for that conversation. But I did want to get sort of just a top view of the challenges that we're facing. Is this a world that I guess Barack Obama has bequeathed to Donald Trump that is coming up roses, or is it not so much at the moment?
No, I think so. I mean, it's Secretary of Defense Mattis, one of the leading figures in our defense establishment in terms of his study of history. He himself has said this is about the most chaotic time in the world stage in terms of the complexity and the variability of threats that he has ever experienced personally. So I think we can't put too fine a point on the status of the world, as you had said, bequeathed by the Obama administration, where it was much more international organization, UN, World Bank, International Monetary Fund. And this kind of apology for the United States being, what it is and what it has represented during the Cold War and the establishing the world order that's benefited us for some 60 or 70 years.
Yeah, and this is not actually conduced to a more safe and secure environment, needless to say. In fact, you've characterized it using one of my favorite metaphors of Winston Churchill's gathering storm, a term he used to describe the run-up to the most horrific conflict in human history. Why do you think that term is apt at the moment? Is it just that it's chaotic, or is it actually that we're now facing, as then, dedicated adversaries who are arming themselves to the teeth with their express purpose being to harm us?
He was talking to the English peoples and talking about the complacency of the West and a freedom-loving people marries up with the aggressiveness and the hostility of enemies to actually embolden your enemies and make the situation worse than it needs to be. So where the United States holds back from confronting the expansionism of China and Russia and the nuclear aspirations of Iran, et cetera, where we hold back from that, it gives them room, right? And it increases their confidence and enables all their activities. And so that's what he was warning about then relative to Nazi Germany and the rise of Hitler. And it's the same thing that we should be concerned about today.
Well, and let's jump to why we should not only be concerned about it, but we should be preparing ourselves to contend with it if, God forbid, we have to militarily. And one of the things that you've pointed out in your writings, Dakota Wood, both in connection with the index of military strength, and more generally is, well, as you put it, the United States military is in a death spiral. Talk about what you mean by that, as well as the implications.
So if I had an operational load that required me to use 100 airplanes so that I could cycle things through and cover down on more than one contingency at a time, and I reduce those airplanes to 50, but I don't reduce the workload, then the fewer number of airplanes have to do twice as much work. They wear out faster. They require more maintenance. The people working on them are worked to the bone. And that's where we're at today, and that the U.S. military has shrunk in size over the last 10 or 15 years in particular. Less money to keep it maintained. So as we lose aircraft, we lose ships either in inventory or because we can't fix them, then the fewer that remain are worked that much harder. So now we have sailors on ships in the Pacific working 100-hour weeks. Only 40 to 45% of airplanes across the entire Marine Corps were even flyable as of December or January this past winter. Within the Air Force, you only have, I think it's 4 combat-coded tactical fighter squadrons out of a total of 32 that are assessed as fully ready. And only 3 of the Army's 31 brigade combat teams could get out the door on short notice. So we have a smaller military working the same or greater workload than a decade ago, and it's just wearing out the force, and you start eating yourself, right? Because you have fewer and fewer things, using it more and more, it wears them out quicker.
Yeah. You know, you approach that in such an interesting way, Dakota, which is actually not surprising given your background in, you know, planning and logistics and all that. You're taking stock of what we have to do missions with. And I'm assuming that adversaries of this country can make similar calculations as well. Do we have enough ships? Do we have enough aircraft? Are they ready to go? When they're making calculations as to whether or not they could take us on, is that how you see it? Are they taking measure of us and perhaps being emboldened by it?
They are, indeed. So the fact that we say things in a public sense through the index about the current state, we have had some criticism about why do we want to make this public. But you know that the analysts in Moscow and Beijing are looking at those same numbers that are all on public record, and other organizations internationally that count numbers, how many tanks, how many ships, you know, where these things are at. So it's all out there, and our enemies look at that. And it used to be in the old days, Cold War, we would have one capital to deal with, Moscow. And so if something was going on in the South Pacific or the North Atlantic, those signals would go back to a single set of decision makers in one capital. And we assessed our capabilities versus the Soviet capabilities. That's gone, but it's actually gotten worse in that we now have, you know, Tehran, Pyongyang, Beijing, and Moscow, 4 different major entities. The Chinese don't care what we might be doing in Northern Europe vis-a-vis Russia. They only care that we're distracted up into the European theater, and then that gives them license to do things other places. So where we have a military that's half the size, 2/3 perhaps, of Cold War levels, that military is sent out in small pieces to the Middle East, the European area, and the Asia-Pacific region. So it's a small percentage that has to go up against the totality of a China or Russia that's operating on their home turf, and they've got all of their force available, and we're working 5 or 8,000 miles from home with just a small piece. And they look at those numbers and our ability to reinforce and actually sustain operations, and it actually gives them confidence and emboldens the very type of behavior that we would be wanting to deter.
Yeah. And in a way, worse yet is the fact that there's abundant reason to believe they are, at the very least, prepared to take advantage of each other's challenges to us, if not actually coordinating their efforts in that regard. So much more to talk with you about, Dakota Woods, in particular, what you and your superb colleagues at the Heritage Foundation are assessing is needed to try to remedy some of these shortfalls in our military and pull out of that death spiral before it's a death spiral for all of us as well. Dakota, we have to leave it at that for the moment, though. Keep up the good work, my friend, at the Heritage Foundation. Come back to us soon, as I hope will the rest of you on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.